You're listening to a Countout Podcast.
Bet365 is paying out before the final whistle.
Check out Bet365's unrivaled early payout offer. When you bet on a team to win and they take a 17-point lead, you get paid no matter the final score. Forget the final whistle and start counting that cash. Hold up. You get early payout on parlays, too.
Download the app and see why it's never ordinary at Bet365. Gambling problem? Call 1-800-GAMBLER. 21 plus only. Must be physically located in Ohio. T&Cs apply.
Warning. The following ZipRecruiter radio spot you are about to hear is going to be filled with F-words.
When you're hiring, we at ZipRecruiter know you can feel frustrated. Forlorn even. Like your efforts are futile. And you can spend a fortune trying to find fabulous people, only to get flooded with candidates who are just fine. Fortunately, ZipRecruiter figured out how to fix all that. And right now, you can try ZipRecruiter for free at ZipRecruiter.com/zip. With ZipRecruiter, you can forget your frustrations because we find the right people for your roles fast, which is our absolute favorite F word. In fact, 4 out of 5 employers who post on ZipRecruiter get a quality candidate within the first day.
Fantastic.
So, whether you need to hire 4, 40, or 400 people, get ready to meet first-rate talent. Just go to ZipRecruiter.com/zip to try ZipRecruiter for free. Don't forget, that's ZipRecruiter.com/zip. Finally, that's ZipRecruiter.com/zip.
Welcome to The Ballot, the podcast where the conversation begins. I'm your host, Ryan Knightsey. And today we are discussing, we're going back to the rest of the world region. A lot of guys in the rest of the world region for being on the ballot for the first time ever. We're going back there for the final time this year with the last person left to discuss. We're going over to, heading on over to England, jolly old England, as it were. And we're discussing the case of Steve Gray, a world of sport wrestler from the 70s and 80s. And what better way to then to get someone to talk about Steve Gray than the guy that has written about him probably several times based on things I discovered right before we recorded. And that is, of course, the writer of the book, We Shall Not Be Moved, The Story of British Wrestling and the Saturday Afternoon War. I have to imagine Steve Gray is in those. And I literally discovered them 30 seconds before we started recording. And I was upset that I just discovered that now. And of course, a article that was not only posted on Alan_Cheapshot's Substack, but of course in the Wrestling Observer newsletter itself, entitled Steve Gray and Hunter from Hall of Fame. We of course have Tony Earnshaw. Tony, welcome to the show.
Hi. Good to be here.
I'm so pleased to have you join for the show. I'm very excited to talk to you and discuss Steve Gray. Obviously I always try to do my own research and own conversation. But like I ask every single guest that comes into our show, I want to know, what is your connection to Steve Gray?
I first started going to watch wrestling in England in 1977. So it makes me quite old. And he was one of the regulars on the show. At one stage, I was going maybe 3-4 times a week to shows. In the summer, it would be 4-6 times a week. And he was just one of the regulars. And, you know, as I started working on the backstage ring crew and things, and I'd get to meet him, talk to him. He was a very nice fella, but he was also a very good wrestler. You know, he was not top of the bill back in that stage, but he was just getting the push up the card. He'd been wrestling since the late 60s, and it was someone that, you know, I liked to watch, always in a good match, and obviously I followed his career, and that was the connection, is that someone, you know, if you, British wrestling is slightly different from American wrestling as such that he was a lightweight, which was... Yep. I think it's 154 pounds, 11 stone limit.
I believe so.
So, and the British tried to make it more a real sports to follow on with the World of Sport program. So it was sort of although it wasn't, it was portrayed as such. So you had the rules, you had the British Wrestling Board of Control, which was only in somebody's imagination, and you had the weight limits, and it was sort of, you know, it wasn't called professional wrestling. When Ken Walton started, it would be welcome to another session of freestyle wrestling, and it was basically, you know, meant to be a proper sport. So, and then, so with the lightweights, the kingpin at the time was Jim Breaks. He was the number one draw. He was the number one attraction at the lightweights. And so when Steve Gray got the push, funny enough, Johnny Saint was the world champion.
Yep.
But Jim Breaks was the number one draw of the lightweights. And he had the European title at the time. When I first started getting interested, Dynamite Kid was the up-and-comer, and that's who Steve Gray wrestled at the Royal Albert Hall in November 77 on the Royal Show. And that was, that was him starting. But it was when Dynamite Kid went to Canada, in April 78, that Steve Gray became, for want of a better word, the new Jim Breaks opponent, rather than Johnny Saint. The baton was passed straight to Steve Gray. And basically, as time went into the late 70s, early 80s, Steve Gray was the number one babyface lightweight and billed as such. So, yeah, it was. And then just watching him, obviously, when the TV ended in the late 80s and stuff, he was still there. He was one of the ones that did carry on well after the. So, you know, I watched his career for the maybe getting on for 40 years. As I say, I'll be honest with you, when I saw he'd been nominated, it was a bit of a shock. But then when you sort of compare to, say, Johnny Saint, who was the equivalent, is you know, they match up. They I would say, in a way, Steve Gray's got stronger credentials because he was booked in a better way. And also, the fact is that he was on TV in the 80s and Johnny Saint wasn't. So there's far more matches with Steve Gray that you can, there's John Lister's ITV wrestling site, that's got all the matches in order. And there's quite a lot more of Steve Gray than Johnny Saint. And there's a quite a good selection of Big Daddy tags, championship matches, wrestling matches, rule breaking matches. So yeah, he's become someone, you know, it's interesting. I think he's, you know, it's a good nomination.
Yeah, I agree. Several points I wanted to react to. And one, I think, is that you sort of mentioned the sort of the ITV website that has basically a database of matches that have been uploaded to YouTube and various sites, right? And what's nice about, you know, I'll say this from a sort of my specific point of view of doing this show, is that covering the people that have been nominated for the first time into the Wrestling Observer Hall of Fame, this is, of the rest of the world region, probably the guy with the most footage available. You know, obviously you have Gilbert Le Duc, which is like a little bit of footage and a whole lot. You have Les Kellett, who has a good amount of footage out there, but it's a lot of his later years, you know, near the later tail of his run. So you don't get to see a lot of the, I guess, quote unquote, more peak years of Les Kellett, let's say. And then, of course, Ted Boy Marino, who there's literally no footage of him wrestling, only footage of him wrestling in a movie that he was in. So you kind of get an idea of what he might have been like in the ring. But luckily for us is that Steve Gray has a decent chunk of footage to be able to follow, has obviously a decent amount of footage as well. And like you said, he has easy comparison points to some people that have already been in the Hall of Fame, like Johnny Saint, I believe what came in last year or 2 years ago. And then Jim Breaks, who, you know, is not in the Hall of Fame. I believe he was nominated in 2012, fell off in 2016. But you know, there's apt comparisons to other Hall of Fame inductees, nominees. That's going to be, I think, fruitful for the conversation today.
But with as you say, the Johnny Saint comparison, for example, as you say, there's next to no matches well, there was not, because Johnny Saint left Giants at the early start of 1982.
Yeah.
And didn't, and he was missing for 5 years while Steve Ray was regular the whole way through. So you could see, like, his basically, you could watch his career develop from the early mid-70s when he was on against McManus on TV, the Cup Final, which was the biggest TV show of the year. And then he obviously did, and you can just see him evolve throughout. And then at the end, he became the one who put the youngsters over. So it went full circle. He started late 70s being put over, being pushed up, and then at, by the end of the TV, he was the one sort of doing the favours for the youngsters.
Yeah.
So it's a nice sort of historical timeline, you know, and there's something, you know, basically you can see every style of his match. And I mean, that's the thing against others, is that sometimes it's hard to work out with European wrestlers because there's just no footage of them. No British, exactly. European, you know, and you, yeah, for someone who's not aware of, shall we say, British European wrestling stars, wrestlers, you can't, you're only sort of voting on what you can read, which is not really a good way to do it, you know. I mean, and that's a shame of British wrestling. You had 50 minutes. Less than an hour every week from the mid-70s. You had before the mid-70s, you had a midweek, half an hour, a couple of matches. You had 3 matches on a Saturday. Some weeks it wasn't on because there was football, soccer, or boxing, or golf, or snooker, and another sport. And so you went, you know, just the footage is just not there. So unless you went, like I did, to the shows, you didn't really see a lot. And the best things were actually at the Royal Albert Hall in London, and they very rarely tape there, you know, once in a blue moon. So,
and that's also a thing I wanted to react to as well, is that, you know, not to obviously speak ill in any way, but I think you are going to be the first guest that we've had that, you know, I guess other than sort of the more extremely modern cases, that if someone has been present to a lot of matches and a lot of his career, not just, you know, and I guess both in front and behind the screen to a lot of ways. So that is something that sort of firsthand point of view is, I think, extremely valuable for a discussion. I'm very excited to learn more of what it was like in the moment. Cause I think I was literally talking to my wife last night. We're big movie fans. We went to a nice double feature screening of Apocalypse Now and Hearts of Darkness, the documentary about the making of the film. And, you know, we had a big conversation regarding context of when a movie is released, and about, you know, whether or not a movie is better within the context or it could be worse. We also recently watched like The Big Lebowski, and that was a movie that in time, when The Big Lebowski came out, everyone reacted like, what the heck is this? At least in America, like, what the heck is this? The Coens just made Fargo, an Oscar winning movie, and then you make a stoner comedy with Jeff Bridges, and everyone getting upset. And then like 10 years later, it's something completely different. I think a thing that is not necessarily a struggle, but sort of a just nature of the beast with a show like this, is that a lot of times we are just looking at artifacts of the shadows of these sort of moments. That's a big thing with Ted Boy Marino, where it's no footage whatsoever, practically. Jay Barely Duke, he has the struggles of Parisian newspaper archives not becoming available to the end of the year at a certain, like, 40-year period. Like, so getting that context in the moment context that you have, I think, is going to be extremely helpful in learning and understanding more of, especially when it comes to historical significance, of what he was in the moment. What's who Steve Gray was as a celebrity, as a wrestler, let's say, in the moment. So I very much appreciate you coming on to the show again.
No problem. But as I say, with my first memories, as I say, he was one of the ultimate baby faces. He was a brilliant comeback. You know, he was, you know, obviously mentioned some names, Jim Briggs, Sid Cooper, Zoltan Bosick, the lightweight villains at the time. And he would, you know, this was in the 70s. And then he suddenly got the main event push at the start of 78. This was when Max Crabtree, Big Daddy's brother, took over the whole show. And obviously he had to replace the Dynamite Kid. And rather than sort of go for the established ones, he picked Steve Ray to take over the title, British lightweight title, and which was, you know, you looked at the names on the list that were competing, and you know, for most people it was a surprise, but he grew into the title. The title, you know, he made the title, and obviously with he could easily wrestle someone, he could easily do a big, this was in 78, do a Big Daddy tag, which wasn't as easy as people sort of, you know, for some like Steve Gray, and then against Haystacks or whoever on the other corner, and you've got to do all the work. And you're doing it against someone three times your size. But that was the thing. He could do the heroic comeback. That was his style, you know, in a Big Daddy tag, in a match against the likes of Jim Breaks, you know, he would be getting it pasted all around the ring, absolutely battered. And then you get the comeback, and of course the crowd would be off their feet and shouting. And he was over. Once he got the title, he became incredibly over. You know, very popular, very, very popular. And that was one of the, I would say, in comparison to Johnny Saint, he was more popular, because I found, I don't know, Johnny Saint a little bit cold, a little bit, you know. He had the same style, but he was never portrayed as being in significant danger. You know, he didn't make the comeback, you know, against Steve Gray, who could spend, you know, several rounds, and all of a sudden he'd pick up. Obviously, he got the surfboard submission off the Dynamite Kid when he left. And the build up to that, you knew what's going to happen. He'd fling someone into the ropes, then go, you know, do a leg weep and kick the leg. So, building up for this submission, and the crowd, the noise was right, you know, and once he sort of got the surfboard submission on, that was it, you know, the crowd was, you know, and then of course they did the thing when he got it, and it was like a few seconds left at the end of the round, which obviously you don't get in America, where it's a British thing, Saved by the Bell, and it was just, you know, he just got the crowd a boiling point at times, you know, championship matches, title match, but he certainly, was well over with the crowd, you know, and then obviously carried on into the 80s, and as I say, he was just incredibly popular. And he was one of those wrestlers that, you know, he didn't have to try, you know, he didn't do anything sort of cheap to get popularity. It was just natural popularity. His style was pleased what people wanted to see. They wanted to see that, you know. And he was a nice guy, so which always helps, you know, he portrayed who he was.
Yeah, we kind of already did like a loose sort of bio on Steve Gray. I guess just to clean a little bit up, he started wrestling in 1970, and appearing in World Sport in 1971. Originally Steve Green, because I believe that was his father's name, who's
Rose Green at the time.
And then
he actually started late 60s, 68, 69, because you... although I have records going back to the late 40s, so, you know, obviously to say they sometimes wrestled in independence or whatever, but there was a magazine in Britain called The Wrestler.
Yes.
It was kayfabe, but it was, you know, and then they did an article, and that would have been 69. He was one to watch. And then and at the time, it was Stan Green, obviously, that was his name. And then it shortly changed to Steve Gray, and then, should I say, then the TV, and then it was Steve Gray. So, but when he started the late 60s into the early 70s, the lightweights at the time, even George Kidd, Johnny Saint, anyone, they were always below the heavyweights. The heavyweights ruled. So no matter who the heavyweight was, it was the heavyweights were number one. Kendo Nagasaki was becoming big at the time. People like that, you know, Tibor Zakash, Steve Vedor, all the big names that... And they would be all of, they used to have many, many foreign from Europe, America come over, do a tour. But it would all, but the lightweights, no matter who they were always not bottom of the bill, but below the heavyweight. So, and so he, it, as I say, with all wrestlers, British wrestlers, even the likes of McManus, Palo, they took years to build up to where they would be top of the bill. But I say, Steve Gray wasn't what I call a top of the bill wrestler as his own right, but he would be in top of the bill matches if you... you could say fingers of 1M, people like Big Daddy, Giant Haystacks, Kendo Nagasaki, Mick McManus were top of the bill. The others will be top of the bill depending on the individual match that night. You know, they could be top of the bill one night, Steve Gray, Jim Breaks. The next night, it'd be Steve Gray, Sid Cooper, and he'd be down the bill. You know, it all depend on. But yeah, as I say, it was a slow burn, and you could watch it as he came up through the early 70s. And you could see that he'd start picking up the win. He'd start getting a slightly more high profile match. And as I say, the real push was starting in 77.
Yep.
When he got the Mick McManus match on the Cup Final World of Sport, which obviously was one that Palo and McManus did and got the millions and millions and millions. And then obviously the Royal Show at the Albert Hall. The worst thing is the TV cameras were there that night, but they didn't film that match.
They just put him there and didn't turn him on.
That was it. There were seven matches and they only showed two on TV and they were seven, matches that you'd all want to see. But that's the trouble, you see. There's so much footage missing.
Yep.
You know, from the 70s, you know, it's in a TV vault. And for ITV's shame, they won't, you know, the wrestling channel of 20 years ago did show quite a bit of it, but there's still so much missing. A lot of Steve Gray's, 70s matches aren't there, which is a great shame. But the ones that are there, are well worth watching.
Totally agree. 100% agree. Yeah, the sort of modern comparison at best I can do, obviously, is in terms of the sort of heavyweight junior style or lightweight style. You know, it's kind of like the modern Japanese, kind of modern, but Japanese style has always been like that way. The separation between the heavyweights and the juniors.
Yeah.
The heavyweights. And it's the same sort of thing that you're talking about, is that, like, you know, in terms of like New Japan or any other Japanese promotion, it's heavyweights are the top of the bill, drawing, main event kind of guys, and the juniors aren't not top, they can be the top of the bill, or it's not necessarily that they aren't draws, it's just they're typically not necessarily in the main event. And that's sort of similar here, at least here. And it should be noted also with Steve Gray's case, that, where he was a lightweight competitor, he was also somebody that I believe competed early on, especially a lot of catchweight bouts, if I'm not mistaken, which was sort of wrestling in not his weight class.
Yeah, the catchweight was basically, again, for the World of Sport, the rules and regulations. So Steve Gray wrestled, say, Bobby Barnes, who was middleweight, light heavyweight. Mm-hmm. That would be billed as a catchweight contest. You know, if you wrestle someone who was heavier than you or someone was lighter than you, as I say, Steve Gray being a lightweight, they would be billed as catchweight matches. And then Kent Walton would give the, commentary, this is a catchweight match and so-and-so's how many pounds heavier. And, that, just to make it look like it was a, some kind of heroic feat that the lighter guy won, So, that was the thing. I mean, it didn't really matter. You can go through the records and most wrestlers. He wrestled Rocco on TV, people like that who were a lot heavier. Mm-hmm. And then obviously he wrestled, even sort of people welterweight, which was the weight classes were basically, you look like a lightweight, you're a lightweight. And they used to say, that there was a weigh-in before a championship match and all the controls supervised the weigh-in. But it was just to make it look like a proper match. So-and-so weighed it, like a boxing match they tried to portray it as. But obviously it was just someone's figment of someone's imagination, what they weighed, and they just looked like it, and that was it. But some of it could be ridiculous. But Steve Gray, he looked like a lightweight. He went as far as welterweight, which is 11 pounds heavier. Mm-hmm. And as I say, that was the run in 1979, which really, that's when he won the title. But doing the run with Jim Breaks up to the Wembley Arena show, that's what put him like up into the real sort of top echelon, And that was the thing. He went from featured match at Wembley Arena, you know, the TV. He did the TV FA Cup final TV again in 1979, which was obviously massive that year because it was Big Daddy and John Quinn in the other match in a tag, the first time they got their hands on each other. So the hype of that, and obviously Steve Brown, it was a fabulous match. I was there when they filmed it, and it the absolute full house. You know, they put the ticket prices up, which is 50 pence, which is whatever it is, you know. But I mean, the ticket was 150. So if you think they put it up to, that's, you know, you've sort of put it up by 50 to every ticket, £2. And it was packed, you know, we bought tickets in advance. But I mean, you had Big Daddy and John Quinn in a tag, and then you had Steve Gray and Jim Brakes for this, because they did started, this was actually again for Dynamite Kids welterweight, British welterweight title. The tournament actually started back in February. It was like a long-running knockout tournament on TV. And then it got to the final with Steve Gravy, Jim Brakes. And obviously it went to a draw. But the whole story of the last few rounds was the surfboard. He got, you know, getting the submission and then trying to get the win. Suddenly the 12th round, bell's gone. You know, you had 12 rounds and it's, you know, so it went to another match on what was like a bank holiday, World of Sport Monday at the end of May. Again, the same thing, the 12 round draw. So now people are really, you know, want to, you know, the obviously you get the 10 million plus watching it. You want this. And then it was one of the second featured match on the Wembley Arena, Big Daddy v. John Quinn. Mm-hmm. So it was just like the second featured match after the main event. Again, it ended, I don't know, it was a bit of a soft ending, but with Brakes, he needed to win the title more than Gray needed the title. But obviously with the ending, with the accidental ending and Brakes gloating and, you know, he put Gray over in defeat, which is what, you know, he came out looking better in defeat because everyone felt sorry for him that he put, you know, got to the last couple of minutes and he had a, you know, accidental fall out the ring. And, you know, he really built him up. And that's one thing you can't say for Johnny Sain. He never had a program like that. It's like what I call a defining program. You know, if you look back, if you say, well, what is the Steve Gray program I should really look at those three matches. They're all on the ITV wrestling. Mm-hmm. The first one, the cup final show, the second one from Wembley Town Hall, and then the third one, the big one at Wembley Arena. The trouble is with Johnny Sain, he didn't have that defining program where he had a series of matches, because we didn't do storylines. We didn't, you know, I mean, World of Sport Wrestling basically was three matches every week, random matches. There was no, very rarely you might get a return match, but you could get a match and they would build up a match, not to go on TV, but to go in the halls.
Yes.
So someone like Kenda Nagasaki, he might have a promo, but the promo would be not to go around to show on TV. It would be to put the match on at the hall. So, I mean, that was the difference. But Johnny Sain, he didn't have what I would call a matches like that. And then, of course, Steve Ray had other matches as well on TV. And that was the thing. If you can sort of look at Steve Gray's that series, and to me, that's some of the best, not just Steve Gray matches, but some of the best TV matches for drama. You know, I mean, mm-hmm. the first one when I was there, the excitement when he was get towards the end and you thought he was going to get the winner, because Jim Brakes, as such, was probably up there one of the most hated villains, you know. It was perfect booking, perfect that, you know. And the ending, when, you know, got to the 12th round, and then, you know, and it was like, you know, Kent Walton putting it over as a big thing. And that's what he could do, Kent Walton. He could make or break any wrestler. Few words in commentary, you know, he's not very good, you know, a bit inexperienced, you know, put him down. Or, oh, you know, I mean, he could put this excitement into the voice. And, you know, and that's what I say, they made it to be a big thing. But you had, the problem is you had shortly after that, and then they had the obviously the Big Daddy John Quinn, and obviously John Quinn left. But the problem is then you had the TV company go on strike. So we never had any World of Sport for 3 months. No wrestling on TV. So all the impetus of things, and you had a lot of things going on in the halls with, you know, not just Steve Gray, but others. And that was it. If you wanted to see wrestling, you couldn't see it on TV for 3 months, you know. But there were matches Steve Gray should have had that were scheduled to be on TV, mm-hmm. and it just didn't happen. So a little bit was lost. But, you know, I mean, it didn't take long to get everything back, because he did a Johnny Saint match and he beat Johnny Saint on TV just into 1980. So, but then the Johnny Saint rivalry, it was, he should have won the title from in 82, but it got, you know, with Johnny Saint leaving, he was going to go over with the belt. So, but yeah, I mean, this was the thing. The matches, I found this match with Johnny Saint weren't that interesting, because they were always the same. And, you know, when you were going to see, you could see the same match 5 times a week, and they never put, you know, Johnny Saint's matches didn't have a lot of variety.
Sure. You know? Yeah. So, I know exactly what you're talking about.
Yeah. I mean, it was a bit of a formula.
Yes, it was a formula, I think, with the – it's sort of the situation that I have a little bit with sort of Zack Sabre Jr. nowadays, who is sort of similar to that sort of chess maneuver, I like to call it. You know, people say the World of Sports style, of course, but that sort of calculated chess style of, I'm going to work this, and then I'm going to work this, and then I'm going to move here. And it's for me, it's one of those things of, like, it with the right person, it can work. With the wrong person, it's just like, I don't really know.
No, I mean, and as they say, you know, you've got to mix it up. You know, if you do the same style match, see, the thing is with the wrestling here was people didn't travel.
Yeah.
So, well, a few did, the likes of myself, the super mad people who did. But so you could have a show. Well, I live in Brighton on the South Coast, so every summer we had weekly shows. We had weekly shows at Worthing, which is 8 miles down the coast. Weekly shows at Eastbourne, 15 miles down the coast. Hastings, a few miles further on. Bognor, a few miles further. And you could see the same matches every night, because they would just move whoever was there, especially if they came down from north for the week. And you would sometimes see the same match, and it would be, oh, no, not again, you know. And for want of a better word, I did find Johnny Saint's matches, depending on who he was on with. But then, obviously, once he left in 82, mm-hmm. he very rarely came down, because, obviously, Independence didn't run a lot down this way. But he did have better matches, because they billed him with the likes of Rocco, mm-hmm. which, obviously, then... You can't not work if you're on with Mark Rocco. You've got to mm-hmm. keep up with him. So, his better matches were probably not on TV, because he was wrestling better wrestlers.
Yeah.
Like the likes of Mark Rocco. So, but, yeah, I mean, that was the thing with Steve Gray. He mixed his styles up. You know, you could see him on with John Cortez or Clive Myers, which would be a technical match, but it would always just be verging just a little bit over the breaking the rules, just a little bit, you know, and there would be a bit of variety. And then he could be on with someone, Sid Cooper, Bobby Barnes, Jim Breaks, and there'd be a pure baby face versus a villain.
Yep.
And then you have the Big Daddy tags, which were something, so, you know, there was always a bit of variety. Johnny Saint, very, very rarely did a tag match. Mm-hmm. And most of his matches were just technical, until obviously went to wrestle for the Independence, and then he did do matches when Jim Breaks went over. He wrestled Jim Breaks a lot. And he wrestled Mark Rowe, but Steve Gray was, you know, Johnny Saint didn't do Big Daddy tags, and he didn't do any, you know, very rarely did any kind of tag. Whereas Steve Gray was a regular, not just in Big Daddies, but, you know, used to do other stuff. So,
yeah, well, we're sort of already talking about the working ability. I'll just open up open that door right now, talking about Steve Gray's working ability. And I think you sort of nailed on the head there, is that he, you know, he certainly had like a wrestling style for sure, but it was more so about, I always thought, his storytelling within the ring, and, like, you know, speaking to him being just an amazing baby face, an amazing underdog baby face, constantly be able to work up to sort of, you know, hot tags, I guess you could say, but also the comeback spots for his sort of matches. He's a great worker. He's an amazing wrestler. The, like you spoke to, the diversity in his wrestling while maintaining that storytelling core, I think was a really valuable thing with him. And obviously being able to do that with tag matches where you're sort of setting up the hot tag, quote unquote, hot tag with Big Daddy, not necessarily the hottest of tags, but certainly the crowd was into it. But you know, and even then it's like Steve Gray is like, he's a great wrestler. Probably, I think certainly just based on the amount of footage I've seen, the better wrestlers of the, in, you know, the first time inductees here, probably certainly near the top of the list in terms of in-ring ability in the rest of the world category. Not necessarily the most charismatic to a guy like Jim Breaks, per se, but very, very great. Like, I would say arguably Hall of Fame worker levels for him.
He was the perfect foil for someone like Jim Breaks.
Exactly.
Of the comebacks, the vulnerability. Everyone wanted to see Jim Breaks get his backside kicked, you know. And then once it happened and once he was getting Jim Breaks in the surfboard or whatever, you know, the big comeback, that was what people wanted to see, and then that was how people, you know, reacted. You know, if you do a comeback and you get the crowd off the feet and shouting and screaming, you've done your job. If you do a comeback and no one's interested, you've not done your job. But, I mean, the same with Big Daddy. He would do all the work, and obviously Big Daddy comes in and saves the day. But that was, I was writing about on the thing, the working ability.
Yeah.
The day, the match, the best, well, people would pay millions to watch this match, but it was never filmed, with the Chris Colt match at the Royal Albert Hall.
Okay.
Basically, I wrote about it in the article. Chris Colt, Joe Cocker, do you know the rock star?
Yes.
Well, Joe Cocker and Chris Colt had been out in London in the afternoon. Chris Colt was in no fit state to perform.
Yes.
He had the big, entrance with Joe Cocker, AC/DC music. His tag partner was a mask guy called the Black Baron. And obviously, top of the bill at the Royal Albert Hall, the place was packed, 5,000-6,000. And Big Daddy, obviously, he didn't carry a match, Big Daddy. He was the it was his part. And then poor Steve Gray had to somehow get this match with Chris Colt just out of it. And somehow he had to be where Chris Colt thought he would be. And he carried it perfectly. He did the move off the top row, Chris Colt, and Steve Gray was there where he should be. And yet he had, you know, Chris Colt was at one stage lying on the ring apron, totally oblivious to what was going on around him. And yet Steve Gray somehow saved the day in him. And that would be his, probably one of his greatest matches, though very few of us, you know, was there, far, you know, the people saw it. But I mean, it was just incredible that his working ability knew that this guy is not there to wrestle. He's, you know, he's just going to be a danger, but he managed to sort of somehow pull the out of the fire and get you know, because that's your top of the bill match. And then obviously Big Daddy came in and finished it off. But if it wasn't for Steve Gray, it would have just been a complete and utter mess. But yeah, they that was the thing with him. He had that ability.
Yeah.
And then I think, you know, I think it's quite rare to know exactly where you should be, what you should be doing, when you should be doing it. But not only that, but to know when your opponent, what your opponent is going to do. Because there's no point you knowing what you're going to do if you're, you know, to put a match together. But that was, everyone said at the time, if it weren't for Steve Gray in that match, it would have just been one hell of a mess.
Yeah.
But yeah, as I say, with the tags, he did the work. They did the work. That was the younger guys, the smaller guys' job was to, you make Big Daddy look good, and that was it. And a lot of them made a lot of money out of it, you know, because Big Daddy didn't wrestle on his own. You know, he needed a tag partner. He needed two opponents. Mm-hmm. And I know a lot of people criticised him, but a lot of people got work, you know, the partner. Some of them was wrestling with him 7 nights a week. The likes of Banger Walsh, Scrubber Daily, the regular opponents. They were on with him 6-7 nights a week as well. And they made, you know, I mean, you can criticise Big Daddy for everything, but, I mean, he certainly gave wrestlers work. And, as I say, Steve Gray did many, many tags of him. And it was always the same formula, but he never He never let the side down. He knew exactly what the job was to do, to take the good hiding, take the beating, get to the corner,
yep,
sit in the corner, half dead, and then Big Daddy get the glory. But then that was it. That was the show. You know, that's what people wanted to see.
Yeah.
You know, and then afterwards, they'd all the people at ringside come up and see how Steve Gray was, because he'd probably been splashed by giant haystacks. And I mean, and it was just part of the show. And it just showed he knew he could carry a match like that. You know, he could carry any kind of match. And that was the working ability. I mean, he didn't have to have a wrestling match. He didn't have to have a rule breaking match. The tag match, funny, I was saying about tag matches, I put a post up on my Twitter today, sent for September 1981. He was tagging with Sammy Lee, you know, so that was his thing of his thing. You know, they build him with other people like that, but Sammy Lee, you know, the biggest, apart from Big Daddy at the time, the biggest star, and he's in tags with him. So mm-hmm. But that was it. We didn't just do the Big Daddy stuff, and then in the later years, sort of mid-80s, then he had this rivalry superstar Mel Saunders, yep. and it was just entertaining. Saunders, they were good friends anyway, so they travelled together. But I mean, they were just brilliant combination, a brilliant chemistry between them, and that was another series of. On the ITV, I think it's 1986. Yeah. And you had three matches there. And it was the last one I wrote was Stanley Blackburn, the AWA president, was sitting ringside and got up. And he, you know, they didn't speak a lot on the TV. It was just straight into the matches, but he actually got up and put them both over because it was a championship match. But that's what I say. He was anyone they put him in with. He could adapt and wrestle, which is good worker. You know, yes. you can drag a match out of someone not as good as you, that's good. But if you can wrestle someone as good as you and make it a good match, then that's you know, it's entertainment. That's what people want to see. They want, you know, entertaining. You pay your money to sit and watch it. You know, you don't want to be bored, do you?
No, I certainly don't. No. I think like Steve Gray. In terms of like a super micro sense, just had a great ability of reacting in the moment. Like you said, the sort of anticipatory sort of reaction to what his opponent is doing, but yeah. Being able to do that in especially like in a, I guess, natural way of 1970s, 80s wrestling. But like, you know, reacting very well and naturally and making it believable, obviously extremely believable. And you know, obviously working in his own singles matches.
Bet365 is paying out before the final whistle.
Check out Bet365's unrivaled early payout offer. When you bet on a team to win and they take a 17-point lead, you get paid no matter the final score. Forget the final whistle and start counting that cash. Hold up, you get early payout on parlays too.
Download the app and see why it's never ordinary at Bet365. Gambling problem? Call 1-800-GAMBLER. 21 plus only. Must be physically located in Ohio. T&Cs apply.
Warning. The following ZipRecruiter radio spot you are about to hear is going to be filled with F-words.
When you're hiring, we at ZipRecruiter know you can feel frustrated. Forlorn even. Like your efforts are futile. And you can spend a fortune trying to find fabulous people, only to get flooded with candidates who are just fine. Fortunately, ZipRecruiter figured out how to fix all that. And right now, you can try ZipRecruiter for free at ZipRecruiter.com/zip. With ZipRecruiter, you can forget your frustrations because we find the right people for your roles fast, which is our absolute favorite F word. In fact, 4 out of 5 employers who post on ZipRecruiter get a quality candidate within the first day.
Fantastic.
So, whether you need to hire 4, 40, or 400 people, get ready to meet first-rate talent. Just go to ZipRecruiter.com/zip to try ZipRecruiter for free. Don't forget, that's ZipRecruiter.com/zip. Finally, that's ZipRecruiter.com/zip.
Trying to lose weight? It's time to try Hers.
At forhers.com/foryou, you can access affordable, doctor-trusted weight loss treatments tailored just for you. These include oral medication kits or compounded GLP-1 injections. Through Hers, pricing for oral medication kits start at just $69 a month for a 10-month plan when paid in full upfront. No hidden fees, no membership fees. You shouldn't have to go out of your way to feel like yourself. Hers brings expert care straight to you with 100% online access to personalized treatment plans that put your goals first. Reach your weight loss goals with help through Hers. Get started at forhers.com/foryou to access affordable, doctor-trusted weight loss plans. That's forhers.com/foryou, forhers.com/foryou. Paid for by Hims and Hers Health. Weight loss by Hers is not available everywhere. Compounded products are not FDA approved or verified for safety, effectiveness, or quality. Prescription required. Restrictions at forhers.com. Apply.
Having the comeback spots and all these sort of things, and then the tags doing that same thing, but instead of building up for his own comeback, getting the hot tag. I want to ask this question for you, since you were there in the moment. Obviously, he's tagging a lot with Big Daddy, and that's obviously bringing him up the card and putting him on a big stage with Big Daddy himself. Was there sort of a reaction to like Steve Gray being sort of like, underappreciated is the word I'm thinking of? Because what we're saying is like he's tagging and then he goes, sells in the corner half dead, tags in Big Daddy, who gets the big, crowd cheers to various shoulder blocks or whatever that he's doing. Was there sort of a thing of like he's underappreciated in that role, or was it getting fully realized in his singles matches?
I think with the thing is with the Big Daddy tag, people sort of knew what they were. And if he did a Big Daddy tag this week and next week he was in a singles match, people didn't matter. There wasn't very much in the way of like continuation.
Sure.
So you could see Big Daddy tag this week and match with say John Cortez next week, but people saw all the Big Daddy partners, they were there just to do the work and make him look good, but some did it better than others, and sure, Steve Ray was one of the better ones. And I think at the end of the day, doing the Big Daddy tags actually made him more popular because he had more of a spotlight.
Agreed.
And that was it. And so you could say, you was in a tag match tonight, next week you're on against Sid Cooper or John Cortez or Dalton Bossett. And I think they made him more popular because he got the bigger spotlight. You do a TV tag with Big Daddy, you've had 10 plus million people watch you and you're getting over, and then you're a big name, you're on the main match on a Saturday afternoon on TV. You can say when you're on doing the house show that night, wherever you are, people are interested, take more interest in you. So I think in a way it was good for a lot of them that they got the spotlight.
Do you have any more things to say about his working ability before moving into Toronto?
I think the TV matches on YouTube and the ITV, you can just see the variety, he's just an all-round professional, consummate professional.
Yes.
And the thing is like we've just been talking, he can do a Big Daddy tag. Tomorrow night he'll wrestle Johnny Saint for the world title. The night after, Jim Breaks for the lightweight title. Mm-hmm. And you'd get a good match every night, but it was a different style of wrestling every night. Yep. And he could turn, and then maybe the next night Bobby Barnes, who's a couple of stone heavier, 20 odd pounds heavier, and every night it didn't matter what the style was, what the match was, he would wrestle it perfectly.
Doing this sort of deep dive into Steve Gray and watching a lot of his matches, I've really loved genuinely like everything I watched. Because it was exactly what we're talking about, the diversity and the opponents, I guess the Big Daddy tags weren't necessarily the greatest of matches per se, but not because of Steve Gray, but it was the diversity and being able, I genuinely like the gym. I watched the Jim Breaks match, one of them, I forget which one it was, right before we went on the call. I saw a Johnny Saint match that I really loved, like genuinely really loved. In just being able to have and wrestle so many different people on a consistent basis and being consistently just consist, like, you know, I walked away feeling like I could have a great match with Steve Gray, and I'm nobody.
Yeah, and that was the beauty. He could make people look good, and no matter what, the, like, some wrestlers couldn't sort of do more than one style, or was a bit for him to the same formula, but he would, you know, could wrestle five different matches in a week, you know, five different style matches in a week, and each one would be good, which is, I think, a solid professional, you know. I think that's why he was so respected by his peers and you know, and the fans, because you never felt let down. You always got a good match.
Yeah.
And that is working ability, isn't it? That is what you would need to see. That's what you want to see.
Yeah.
So, I mean, as I say, having watched him, and, you know, obviously as we all get older, when he was sort of getting into the mid to late 80s, you know, the style did slightly slow down, but then he made up for it in other ways, you know, and you know, they worked accordingly, but you didn't feel that the wrestling was any the worse for it, which is another good thing.
Yeah, I 100% agree. Yeah. Well, like I said, I really like his wrestling. I think his wrestling ability is probably his strongest category in this sort of case for him. So let's move into maybe his weakest category, probably, of his drawing power. There is obviously something there, not a whole lot there, probably, because of kind of what we sort of talked about. You have the construction between the heavyweights and the lightweights, and sort of the weight class structure of these sort of shows is the same sort of thing that, like, when you talk about, like I said, juniors in New Japan or something, where it's just like, it's just kind of what it is. He was obviously on top and a top draw when it came to lightweights for several years. I think former guest on the show, Ethan Tyler, had him at 4 years as a top draw in the UK, which for him, he was a world lightweight champion multiple times, British lightweight champion multiple times. So obviously that has to denote some sort of popularity and drawing ability. It's just, again, it's sort of the thing of he's a lightweight, not a heavyweight. And then I don't want to, we could get into it, Tony, but the whole, he's working in a promotion with the Crabtrees and the wrestling attendance slowly sort of going away as the years go on. That's also the macro of this whole conversation as well.
Yeah, I mean, the thing is the titles by the 80s didn't really have any sort of effect on the draw.
Yeah.
You know, by then, certain titles were booked to mean something, i.e. Rocco's title before he left, Marty Jones's world title, the one that he had with Owen Hart, them sort of matches on TV. So they made that out to be a big thing. The other titles, Maxine's title, meant nothing because he wouldn't lose it to anyone. You know, and the heavyweight title disappeared with Tony St. Clair, and then Wayne Bridges with the world title disappeared. So by the sort of 82, 83 titles, they were okay, but in the 60s, you could put 50 pence on the bill, on the ticket price, because you had a title match on the show.
Yeah.
By the 80s, title matches weren't even top of the bill. You know, Big Daddy was top of the bill. You might get a title match as well, which is nice, but they didn't change hands. Very, very rarely did a title change hands unless it was on TV by the sort of 80s. So you'd have a title match, but you knew you wouldn't get a title change. And I mean, that was Max Crabtree's fault in a way. He took the eye off the ball. All it was Big Daddy. And then he had to obviously put more wrestlers on the show because you can't have Big Daddy wrestling himself. And sometimes he would put a title match on as part of the show. But, you know, they just didn't, the title didn't mean anything. The only thing that was really important, say we get to the mid 80s. On the joint promotion show as Big Daddy, but you still needed the other wrestlers on the show. And if Steve Gray, people like that were on the show, that was it. But it was the trouble is with Steve Gray, he was one of the main wrestlers on the decline.
Yeah.
But it wasn't his fault, wasn't a lot of wrestlers' fault, that wrong time, wrong place.
Yeah.
And it was such a shame that, you know, there's a few of them, like when he lost the title to Kid McCoy, that was around about 87. Now, Kid McCoy, in another era, one of the things, he was too early,
yeah,
and he was too late. Yeah. I mean, you know, if 10 years later, he'd have probably been a big star over in the States and Japan because he was that good a wrestler. And 10 years earlier, he would have been with the Dynamite Kid and people like that. But it came in at the late 80s when and just fizzled out. But that was the problem with the wrestlers then. Once the TV finished, very few stuck around because it just wasn't the work. There was, you know, you couldn't make it. But as I say, Steve Gray, you know, by the time the TV finished, he was sort of getting older anyway. But that was just unfortunate that when the matches started drying up, because obviously they were putting on, instead of like 6, 7, 8, 9 shows a night, joint promotions, you might get one or two.
Yeah.
And so, you know, you calculate how many wrestlers on 9 shows against 2 wrestlers, 2 shows for wrestlers. And it was a shame. So that is one of the things you can't say that was down to any wrestler because it was an outside combination of the, obviously, by the time we get to 86, 87, you got the WWF poking in on the ITV show. And with all the will in the world, you can't put, say, Steve Gray up against Hulk Hogan in Madison Square Garden and Steve Gray's at Dewsbury Town Hall. You know, that was one of the things. It was just, and it was like all British wrestlers, people all of a sudden saw these, even the British Bulldogs, they saw Hogan and Savage and everyone, Andre the Giant. Wow. And then next week it's Steve Gray or Pat Roach or somebody. It just couldn't compare. So that was the beginning of the end. And it was just history, really.
Yeah.
I mean, to be honest, even if he had been 10 years before, he would never have been top of the bill. You know, most British wrestlers, they weren't ticket sellers. The ticket seller was wrestling. He put a poster up outside a hall every Monday night, wrestling. People didn't care who was on. They just wanted to watch wrestling.
Yeah.
And so the actual draw was wrestling. They went every Monday or Tuesday night or every fortnight, whatever it was, and they just went to watch wrestling. You know, they ran shows in London the same night as the Wembley Arena shows up the road. So you've got Wembley in North London, you've got your massive big show of the year, and down the road, you've got a local show, so, you know, joint promotions, because people who lived near the town, or say Battersea, which was by, you know, a few miles down the road, we wouldn't go to Wembley. They wanted to go around the corner to Battersea. And even though the matches at Battersea were nothing like what you were watching at Wembley Arena, that was it. They were creatures of habit. So, you know, the people like myself, you would buy your ticket, but it's like a season ticket. So you had the same seat every show through the year. You just, you know, and it was like you didn't mind who was on. You just went to see the wrestling, and that's what it was. So you had the breakouts, the McManus, Palo, sure, Nagasaki, Haystacks, Big Daddy. Very few were of that level. So Steve Gray was not that level. And he probably wasn't the level below. But it didn't matter because people went, oh, Steve Gray's on. But they wouldn't buy a ticket to see Steve Gray, but they'd be pleased he was on.
Yeah.
And that would be like 99% of wrestlers. They went to see the wrestling.
Yeah.
And whoever was on was a bonus if they liked Steve Gray or someone they didn't like, Jim Briggs or Bobby Barnes or someone. And obviously, if Big Daddy was on, they put extra posters up and extra publicity to sell the tickets. But the shows mainly, especially down south of England, they were all... So the local council, the city council, the city corporation would actually pay for the wrestling. So they would have a hall, like we've got a hall down the road here, and the corporation, right, Dale Martin Promotions, we want wrestling on Thursday night. And then all they had to do was supply the ring, supply the wrestlers, the referee, etc. The corporation would put all the posters up, they would sell the tickets, they would do publicity, everything. And that's how it worked. And that was the other thing that stopped the wrestling, was when, a bit of politics here, when Maggie Thatcher came to power, she cut the local government budget. So one of the first things that went, not just, you know, they put on entertainment shows, variety shows, you know, especially like seaside places like this, you'd have the whole summer, would have different shows, places like Blackpool. But they cut the local authority budget. And one of the things that went was wrestling.
Yeah.
So when you know that in 1982 we went from shows every few weeks to a weekly show in summer to a weekly show in summer, and then by the mid 80s that was it, wrestling was finished. And that, and so it was just a lot of wrestlers, and Steve Gray was one of them. It was just obviously unfortunate circumstances. But as for his drawing power, that is a weak link.
Yeah,
I'd say. Yeah.
And did so? You say that he had, or rather, didn't have strong drawing power, and mostly, you know, because of what we sort of talked about already, the heavyweight stuff, and he's not necessarily one of those guys. It's, you know, the big daddies of the world, and it's sort of also treated like. Like the boxing, like the world of sport thing, where it's like it's you don't have storylines, it's kind of show to show.
Yeah.
Now, in his series of matches, like with Jim Breaks, for example, what did you see any sort of, is there sort of any argument that like the crowd is going to see that sort of match? Because if I recall, like, you know, going to a rematch, I think they went to a double rematch, I guess, technically.
Yeah, it went from one, you had the first original, the second rematch, then the third one was there must be a ending, there must be a winner.
Did that build up? Because I believe it did sell out crowds, but I don't recall if that was in the main events or anything.
Oh, no, around the halls, yeah, they booked the match around the halls, mm-hmm. you know, around the time, Jim Breaks, Steve Ray, that was a... You know, obviously it wasn't for the title, but it did the rounds at the time. It did the rounds quite a bit, and that was a top of the bill match, Jim Breaks v Steve Ray. That did sell tickets, and you know that was a, you know, if Big Daddy wasn't on whatever show or Haystacks or whoever, that was a legitimate top of the bill and a legitimate ticket seller.
Because I think they were also one of the main events on one of the Cup shows, if I'm not mistaken.
Yeah, that was
78, I think.
They did 78. They did the World of Sport Cup final show.
Yeah,
that was just a spot match. You know, that was just, there was no storyline. Drake's and Gray just won the title, and they focused on him for the World of Sport FA Cup final show, and then he got then the big show at the end of the year. Before the Wembley Arena was the last show of the year, the Royal Albert Hall, the end of May. That was the big show. Mm-hmm. And that was when the 1978, he got the match with Johnny Saint at the Steve Gravy Johnson. But he obviously, Big Daddy was top of the bill. But that was the kickoff of the Big Daddy brand, Max Crabtree and the thing. Yeah. But he was on the first show Max Crabtree booked. He was on with Jim Breaks at the Royal Albert Hall in March. And then he did a follow up with Johnny Saint. So he was a regular, and he was always in what I call featured matches. Mm-hmm. You know, he wasn't. You know, by the time he came to 78, but yeah, he was a draw. I mean, he was a good name to put on a card. You know, when people started putting their own shows on once the TV days had finished, you know, he was one of the names you could put like top of the bill on a. You know, say you had a small hall show. And Steve Ray would sell tickets, you know, because people knew the name from the TV. And he was one of the most recognisable faces that continued after the TV. So if you were running a small show, say 200 seats, 250, 300 seats, Steve Ray would be top of the bill and would sell tickets because mm-hmm. he was a name people. Oh, yeah, Steve Gray, I remember him.
Yeah.
And that would sell tickets, yeah.
He's, you know, we've had this sort of conversation on the show before about you know, different guests have different definitions of drawing, which some people are very by the books looking at numbers. Some people are saying, you know, a very broad sense of the term. I think if you want to apply any sort of drawing case to Steve Gray, it would be the broad sense of the term is like, he's a guy that people knew that would attract audiences to see a show, but it's not necessarily that he is, for lack of a better term, putting butts in seats, let's say.
I think that's the thing. Because people wouldn't necessarily care. They would buy the ticket to see the wrestling, as I said.
Yeah.
But if Jim Breaks v Steve Gray was the top of the bill that week,
yeah,
And that was it. It was, or if people were sort of looking at the show, oh yeah, Steve Gray's on next week. Make sure, you know, Steve Gray be Jim Breaks or whatever. Make sure we come, you know. So,
yeah.
But I mean, as a standalone draw, not many in British wrestling were, because by the time you got to the start of the 80s, it was Big Daddy up there and the rest were down there, and everything was Big Daddy. But that was it, because people forget it's a business, professional wrestling. You're there to make money. And, you know, people say, oh, Big Daddy and that, for want of a word, killed the job. They didn't. Big Daddy kept it going, because, I mean, wrestling was struggling in the 70s, and Big Daddy gave British wrestling, Big Daddy gave it a new lease of life. And if it, and, you know, by the mid 70s, the TV ratings and that had declined, and it was Big Daddy, you know, with the, obviously the things like John Quinn and Giant Haystack's rivalries. But if, as I say, you know, you don't just have Big Daddy on a show, you have other wrestlers, and it's up to the other wrestlers to seize the opportunity to make names for themselves, and that's what he did. So, I mean, you know, he was, for people of my era at that time, you say Steve Gray, the wrestler, oh yeah, we know Steve Gray. So, I mean, that's one of the names you can say to be like my mum. She's not a wrestling fan, but she knows who Steve Gray is. And so that could be considered good drawing power. You know, if you've got name recognition among non-wrestling fans or very, very casual fans who haven't seen a wrestling match since 1988 when they turned the TV off, then you know, that's one of the things. You know, you've got to be a certain era, of course. You've got to be sort of in, you know, over 50s. But, I mean, you still, you know, you talk to people now about British wrestling, it's still Big Daddy, it's still Giant Haystacks, McManus, Nagasaki. Mm-hmm. I mean, you ask, as you say, Zack Sabre Jr., Will Ospreay,
sure.
You know, even the ones in the WWE, they've got no name recognition unless the youngsters, you know, you've got this separation. Yes. So under 40s, they know the WWE, I still watch WWE, the AEW and all the indie shows and everything. And then you've got the gap that remember that, and there's no in between, you know, there's very few, you know, I still go to shows and look at stuff, but there's very few people, you know, once the British wrestling stopped on TV and once the Hall shows died out in the early 90s, that was it for most people. You know, you had people who've been going for 40 years and just, they didn't want to go WWE, they didn't care about American Style. And that was it. But you still, Steve Gray is still a name that people remember and recognise. And, you know, as I say, he was one of them people that as I say, name recognition is well up there.
That sort of perfectly leads us to the historical significance of Steve Gray. You know, I think as a guy that is probably one of the better workers of that era, he's getting marks there, you know, positive marks there for being a great wrestler for a long period of time. Longevity, if you want to throw that in there, a guy that wrestled for nearly, I think, around 30 years. But
he was wrestling up in well into the 2000s. So
yeah,
a good, probably nearer 40. So,
yeah, probably, yeah. And he's still refereeing, if I'm not mistaken.
Yeah, he wrestled referee to John Fremantle's Premier Promotions. So he's still involved, you know. So,
A thing I like to talk about when it comes to historical significance is the canon of pro wrestling. You know, the sort of like the, if you were to write a book, which you have, on British wrestling, you know, how often is a guy like Steve Gray going to come up? You know, obviously, Big Daddy's going to come up probably on every page and for a lot of it. But, you know, how often is a guy like Steve Gray, like, you know, saying things like, you know, your mother might know who Steve Gray is. To me, that reads as like, oh, there is something that permeates the wrestling bubble and goes into the modern thing, and goes into the usual, the normie, the quote unquote normie. What to you, you know, how important was Steve Gray as someone that grew up in the exact moment of his career? How important was Steve Gray to the British scene, or the British scene in general?
Well, funny enough, in my books, I've written quite a lot about him because there was so much. He had, you know, I say when the first push in 78, obviously the Jim Breaks Matches in 79 feature in one of the books quite a lot. Mm-hmm. And then in the 80s, after Johnny Saint departed in 82, he was the top lightweight babyface through most of the 80s of the for joint promotions with the time left on TV. So he's got a, you know, a place where obviously I wrote quite a bit about him because he did feature on TV and that's what people remember about the TV days is they remember the wrestlers they saw on TV. So I mean, obviously, you know, without the TV, that's different because obviously no one had that, you know, you lost the name recognition, whatever people say, if you're not on TV, people forget about you. That was one of the things with the likes of Rocco and Tony St. Clair, Wayne Bridges, Johnny Saint, when they left because they're not on TV, it was, oh, we thought you'd retired. You know, when they came back on TV in 87, oh, we thought you'd retired because we didn't see you because people went to their local show, joint promotion show, mm-hmm. and they didn't know what was happening on independent shows down the road because there was no way of finding out unless you were a sort of ultra wrestling fan who used to travel the halls, sure. which there weren't a lot of. But, yeah, as I say, he was the main sort of carrier of the lightweight division through the 80s on the TV. And at the end of the day, that's what sells the tickets and brings the money in is being on TV. And, you know, he did the job, you know. And so that was one of the things that, yeah, he's got this name recognition. He's got the match quality. And as I say, within history for writing the books, he did feature because, I mean, there were so many decent matches to write about, you know, it's purely as wrestling, there was, you know, nothing else because people, you know, there weren't nothing else. You just wrote about the quality of the matches, you know, what you saw on TV, events you saw in halls, you had the pushes with the various titles and everything. And it's like everything, if he wasn't up to it, he wouldn't have got all the title runs. And so, yeah, so as a sort of more sort of late 70s through for the sort of, say, 77, 78 to the end of TV in 88, he was one of the most sort of up there with the, you know, lightweights because people knew, you know, because he was on TV and people saw him and they, you know, they wanted to see him. And that's one of the things. So, yeah, he had a name recognition and he had that thing that, as I say, he could you'd see a good match with him.
And we cannot relitigate the sort of Johnny Saint and also Big Daddy Hall of Fame inclusions and not inclusions, but something that I'm only bringing this up because I think one thing about the Johnny Saint case, obviously, is a lot of people, especially like modern U.S. wrestlers themselves, would attribute Johnny Saint to that sort of you know, the guy, the World of Sport guy that we watched a whole bunch of his tapes. I was looking around online to see if I can find any other stuff about Steve Gray. It was actually a quote tweet to your article that Alan posted that said, you know, Steve Gray versus Clive Myers, this is the quote, was the first British wrestling U.S. wrestlers of 1999 and 2000 had seen and borrowed what they saw a few years before Johnny Saint got popular in the U.S. So if you're looking at something, you know, a guy that I know you wrote an entire article about the compare and contrasting of him and Johnny Saint, but as a guy that potentially helped, you know, almost like a weird pioneer of American World of Sport loving in Steve Gray, there's something that, you know, as according to the Wrestling Observer Hall of Fame, something that a lot of people value in that. So I think there's something to be said there.
I think
it's good. It's got to be good, probably. Well, but there's something
One of the things with Johnny Saint, he actually became popular without people seeing his matches. I mean, that was the thing. There was suddenly this sort of thing. Oh yeah, Johnny Saint. We got to, you know, John. But Johnny Saint was a derivative of George Kidd, whose matches were ultra rare. There's about one or two you can find on TV because obviously when he was popular, he didn't go on TV, he wouldn't do the TV. So Johnny Saint's matches were actually derivative of George Kidd at the time, you know, the chain wrestling and the moves and the escape moves and everything, whereas Steve Gray had more of a unique style and there obviously is more. But as I say, with Johnny Saint, you can say the same thing. Obviously, we're just talking about his drawing power and everything and that. I mean, Johnny Saint actually sort of significance was well after he finished, because all of a sudden in the States he became this person that people think, oh, we must like Johnny Saint, but without actually doing a deep dive into why you must like him. Whereas with Steve Gray, if you were like Steve Gray, you can sit for a next week and watch his matches on YouTube and you can see why you like Steve Gray.
Yeah.
You know, they're totally different styles, both baby faces, but, you know, complete opposite style-wise. And I don't think one's wrong and one's right. I think both should be in the Hall of Fame, you know. So that's the thing, you know. I mean, if you sort of think one's in, well, that's good. I like, you know, I voted for Johnny Saint last year myself. Mm-hmm. But I think as with Steve Gray, you know, it's not an either-or. Let's get both in, because both, for the lightweight British style, European style of wrestling, they are both supreme exponents and should be recognised. You know, it's not a sort of binary decision. If you like Johnny Saint, you can't like Steve Gray. You know, you can appreciate both because they were both baby face wrestlers, but they couldn't have been more opposite the way they wrestled. So, yeah, I think my sort of point of view is let's get Steve Gray in alongside Johnny Saint.
I agree. I very much agree. Well, again, Tony, thank you very much for being a part of the show. His article, Steve Gray in the Observer Hall of Fame. It's in the Wrestling Observer newsletter. If you don't have a subscription, I'll be posting a Substack in the link below. Before we go, two little bits that I want to end here for you, Tony, is, you know, I'm going to pull up the Rest of the World region just so I can get your thoughts on the Rest of the World. So we can get some quick thoughts on what else you think. Would you vote for Steve Gray here in this Hall of Fame? Sounds like you might. But before I talk about that, I want to give you the opportunity. Was there any other things that about Steve Gray's case that we haven't necessarily talked about? Or more importantly, any final thoughts, any sort of final drives to try to get people to vote if you're pro case?
I just think, If you voted for Johnny Saint, I mean, as I just said this a couple of minutes ago, the case for Steve Gray is alongside him. You know, it's not an either or, you know, if you like. But, I mean, watch his matches, you know, look at them. You know, if you want to see a great stylist, a lightweight wrestler, which is obviously unique to British wrestling, then that's well worth seeing. And at the end of the day, he's deserving as a British wrestler. It's a bit of a surprise choice to see him on the ballot paper, but once he was on it, I think, you know, I think people should have a look and obviously judge for yourself, but there is a very, very good case for him to go in this year.
Yeah, I tend to agree. I have here up, if you can see it, I don't know what the best version of the our screen is. That works enough. This is the ballot as it's currently situated with the Rest of the World region. 13 acts as of believed to be, you know, obviously every once in a while Dave might throw in someone last minute that wasn't previously announced. I don't get the sense that will happen this year with the Rest of the World region, but so far of what we know of, 13 acts, there'll be 4 votes then. Who is in there or who is on the ballot presumably this year is Jose Torres, Spiros Arion, the Royal Brothers, Adrian Street, George Gordienko, Billy Joyce, Otto Vons, Dominic DiNucci, Killer Carl Cox, Gilbert Le Duc, Steve Gray, that's spelled wrong, Ted Boy Marino, and Les Kellett. Tony, it's your question. Who are you probably going to vote for in this year's Hall of Fame Rest of the World region?
I look through that. Spiros Arion I voted for last year. Mm-hmm. I mean, purely because he did a British tour in 1979 and he was incredibly over as one of the, he was more hated than John Quinn, and that's saying something at the time. If anyone look up a match on YouTube, Spiros Arion v. Colin Joynson, 1979 on World of Sport. It is one round, 5 minutes of absolute havoc. No wrestling, just fighting. And it was totally and utterly out of control. And then Big Daddy came in at the end. It was just absolute mayhem. But, yeah, he was absolutely incredible, absolutely sensational. But, you know, he obviously wrestled in the 60s here, which I was too young to see. But he was a solid choice last year. The Royal Brothers I voted for last year, they were the up until Big Daddy, they were the number one babyface tag team. They were incredibly over in the 70s, 60s and 70s. Really, really another level of popularity and absolutely fantastic. They were the ones... Adrian Street, no. I mean, I just didn't rate him. I just didn't rate him.
Sure.
Didn't rate him. You know, he sort of joint promotions let him go. He tried to do his own promotion. He wanted to come back to joint promotions. They wouldn't have him. He went to the States, but the gimmick just outwore its usefulness. It just, nothing changed, the same gimmick, you know. And the problem is with that, he couldn't handle the crowds. That's why he was always getting arrested for fighting with the crowds, and you can't do that. So,
yeah.
George Gordienko, I never saw him live. Read a lot about him. And again, I voted for him last year. Tremendous strongman wrestler. Did a lot of wrestling in the UK at the time. Billy Joyce, another one. There's no footage out there whatsoever. Mm-hmm. This is a difficult thing, all these names.
I am putting you on the spot as well.
So yeah, this is a shame. I'd love to see his matches.
Yeah.
Otto Vance, I saw him once at the Royal Albert Hall. He came over in 1984 to for his world title, the CWA title. Mm-hmm. And he wrestled a British heavyweight, the Ray Steele, and it was just rolled him over. You know, it was a four or five rounds of complete nothing. But yeah, I've seen him on TV. You know, there's plenty of other advanced matches. You know, he's decent. Dominic DiNucci, not seen a lot of him, or Carl Cox. Gil LeDuc, the same. That's again, not someone I've seen a lot of. Obviously, we've been speaking about Steve Grave the last hour or so. Same with Ted Boy Marino. Les Kellett, I wouldn't have him in. I would not vote for Les Kellett under any circumstances.
A strong reaction. Can I ask why?
No, I mean, if Big Daddy's not in, then Les Kellett can't be in. You know, the match quality is poor. Yeah, he had drawing ability for a few years, but I mean, I saw him when he was in the mid-80s wrestling, and it was just embarrassing, you know. Mm-hmm. I mean, yeah, he had this reputation, and the match, every match was the same. He'd do the same spots in every match. And no way, I wouldn't vote for him. I wouldn't. There's not one piece of the criteria that I think he qualifies. But I mean, if you can't put Big Daddy in and Les Kellett goes in, then that's a criminal outrage. You know, it's just my point of view. But I was a strong, you know, I wanted Big Daddy in. I was a strong supporter of Alan Blackstock and his campaign. I supported that vigorously. And Big Daddy out, you know, if you go by the criteria that Big Daddy wouldn't mm-hmm. get in, then that would be the same with Les Kellett. Mm-hmm. The only thing with Les Kellett is he's still got the name. You know, people of a certain age remember Les Kellett, and that's the only thing I can say positive about him.
Yeah,
but I wouldn't. No way would I vote for him.
As someone that doesn't necessarily sound like the biggest Johnny Saint guy in terms of the formulaic wrestling, I can see why you wouldn't really appreciate Les Kellett's formulaic comedic wrestling.
Yeah, I mean, I was never a big fan of comedy wrestlers anyway.
Sure. You know?
I mean, there were some, but the problems with comedy wrestlers, Cat Weasel, Johnny Quango, Billy Tarantas, all the one, what we call the last bout of the night, send the crowd home happy. You saw the same thing night up. It was just one match. That they only could wrestle one match. Mm-hmm. The comedy, the you know, the crowd liked it, but it's this thing, if you see it three or four times a week and you see the same spot at the same time, it just got boring.
Yeah,
and it's the same with Les Kellett, the rope where he fell through the ropes or did the spinning round stuff. I mean, people liked it, but it just wasn't for me. I mean, with Johnny Saint, that was formulaic, but there was a good wrestling ability. You know, there was sure. a wrestler there. With Les Kellett, I don't know, it just wasn't for me.
Sure, that's totally fair.
Yeah.
So right now you're probably sitting on and I, you know, things could change in the next month or so. I assume the next month or so is when the balance will come out. So right now you're sitting on Spiros Arion, the Royal Brothers, George Gordienko, and I assume Steve Gray.
Strongly Steve Gray, yeah. That would be lovely this year to get him in alongside Johnny Saint. Then we got the two finest, well, amongst the two, so I can't say that, you know, there were others of the 70s and 80s, but
sure,
of the finest British European lightweight wrestlers of that time. So it would be good to see Steve Gray in with Johnny Saint. It's not an either or, you know, they both deserve to be in. So that would be nice. And as if we can get the Royal Brothers in as well, that'd be even better.
Well, then there we go, folks. That's Tony's ballot. We'll make sure it's correct in the next month when these ballots drop, presumably in the next month. I hope I have one more episode to do before hopefully before the ballots come out. So hopefully Dave doesn't drop them randomly next week or so in September. Well, Tony, thank you so much. So very much for coming on to the show. Your point of view and your research, everything is extremely valuable for a show like this, where that firsthand knowledge is so important for me to have. And it was such a pleasure to speak to you about Steve Gray.
Pleasure for me too.
Is there any sort of, obviously we'll have the article and the links below. Is there any sort of last minute classic podcast ending, any last minute plugs or whatnot that you want to
make? Yeah, my books are on Amazon if you're interested. The Saturday Afternoon War and also We Should Not Be Booed, both available on Amazon, very reasonable price.
I'll put those in the link below as well. I think it was maybe a minute or two right before we went on the air. I was just looking at your Twitter and I saw, I think you made a post about like, oh, good thing for Christmas shopping or something.
Yeah.
And I was like, what is this? And I was like, oh darn, I should have read this weeks ago. What am I doing? I didn't even know it existed.
Yeah. They've been out about 3 or 4 years now, but
I'm 100%. I'm very interested in reading these books, so I'm going to try to track them down.
Yeah, they'll say they're still up there on Amazon. So,
yes, hopefully, if I buy the paperbacks, they won't take forever to come to the States. We'll find out.
They're print on demand, so you should be able to get them straight away. So, hopefully, anyway.
Perfect. Well, then there you go. It's easy for everyone to go out and purchase these books written by Tony. Tony, thank you so much for coming on to the ballot. We'll talk to you all next month when we talk about a whole nother wrestler. And until next time, have a good day, everybody. Goodbye.
This has been a Count Out Podcast.
Hey, have you guys heard of the new show on the Count Out Network, the Ichiban Sweetcast?
It's the brand new Japan Pro Wrestling podcast starring the International Wrestling Grand Prix. That's me, your good friend Curtis Spears.
And me, your bad friend Rafe Hewson. And we're here to talk about everything New Japan Pro Wrestling, reacting to everything, getting worked up, getting very happy, sometimes crying. Kind of like something else we used to do, right?
Oh, yeah. That was the old Okada Shorts podcast, right?
Ah, that's right. And if you love that show, you're going to love this show because it's exactly the same show.
Yeah, we just had to change the name.
Yeah, we did. But you can check it everywhere on a social media handle that we haven't made yet.
Yeah, we're really new to this. So what you can do is search on your favorite podcast catcher of choice. Look for the Ichiban Sweetcast.
Sweetcast, Ichiban.
Listen up, football fans. You won't want to miss this.
Right now, new Bet365 customers bet $5 and get $300 in bonus bets, win or lose. So you could turn that $300 into something bigger when you bet on money lines, spread, totals, player props.
$300 in bonus bets when new customers bet $5. I know where I'm going to bet from now on. Download the app today and see why it's never ordinary at Bet365.
Gambling problem? Call 1-800-GAMBLER. 21 plus only. Must be physically located in Ohio. T&Cs apply. In-app only.
Warning, the following ZipRecruiter radio spot you are about to hear is going to be filled with F-words.
When you're hiring, we at ZipRecruiter know you can feel frustrated, forlorn even, like your efforts are futile, and you can spend a fortune trying to find fabulous people, only to get flooded with candidates who are just fine. Fortunately, ZipRecruiter figured out how to fix all that. And right now, you can try ZipRecruiter for free at ZipRecruiter.com/zip. With ZipRecruiter, you can forget your frustrations because we find the right people for your roles fast, which is our absolute favorite F word. In fact, 4 out of 5 employers who post on ZipRecruiter get a quality candidate within the first day.
Fantastic.
So whether you need to hire 4, 40, or 400 people, get ready to meet first-rate talent. Just go to ZipRecruiter.com/zip to try ZipRecruiter for free. Don't forget, that's ZipRecruiter.com/zip. Finally, that's ZipRecruiter.com/zip.